apologize in advance. Welcome, everybody. Welcome. We do have kiddos with us, and we put some coloring sheets and other materials in the back. We just put those out. Usually we put those out at the beginning of worship, and they burned through them by the first two songs. And so we figured, all right, we're clever here. We can outwit these sweet children. So we've waited to put them out until, you know, the message begins. So there you go. How many of you watched the Michigan basketball game last night? Interesting. So some fans are here. Good. Some of you are like, what are you talking about? You know, right? Sports. Football is over, Nate. It is. If you didn't see the game, one way I might describe it is that it was something like a resurrection story. If you're a Michigan fan, anyway. Because the first two-thirds of the game, Michigan was like dead. You know, they didn't know what the orange sphere was that they held in their hand and what they were supposed to do with it. And then suddenly, miraculously, somewhere through the second period, things turn and they can't miss and their offense looks crisp and their defense tightens up. So it's a resurrection story. There you go, Easter, early for those of you who are fans. Today I do actually want to talk about three resurrection stories. And you may be saying, well, hold on, I thought Easter was like about the resurrection story. And it is. It is about the one who came and was betrayed and abandoned and denied and spit on and mocked and hung on a cross in order to take away the pain and the hurt and the loss and to redeem it into something new. Yes, Easter is about that resurrection story. The resurrection story. But that resurrection story has led to countless other resurrection stories. And in fact, still, I'm going to contend to you, the resurrection is happening today. That it's happening right here, right now, in our lives, in this place, because of the resurrection story. So I want to look at three of them, and they all come from the Gospel of John. And you can turn there if you want, or you can just listen. But John tells three stories after the resurrection, starting in chapter 20. Mary goes to the tomb to continue the burial rituals. She's the first story we'll look at. And she gets to the tomb and it's empty, so she runs back to the disciples, tells them what's happening. So Simon and John run back to the tomb with her, and they, in fact, find it empty. And then Mary stays there, and in, let's see, verse 10. Then the disciples went back to their homes, but Mary stood outside the tomb crying. And as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. And they asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They've taken away my Lord," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means, teacher. So this is Mary Magdalene's story, and she is no doubt heartbroken, grieving, and confused. She's gone to continue the burial rituals, and she gets there in her grief and finds that the body has been, in her mind, logically stolen. It's like a sucker punch, right? And so she's confused and terrified and heartbroken. That's Mary's story, at least part of it. If we move ahead a few verses, we get to the second story I want to look at, which is Thomas's story, starting there in verse 24. Now Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. Jesus came to the other disciples. Thomas wasn't there. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them this time. And though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." And Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." So Thomas is, as we call him, of course, doubting. Doubting Thomas. That's the poor nickname this guy has received throughout the millennia. But behind the doubt is hurt and a sense of being lost. Yeah, he's kind of stubborn. Yeah, he's demanding hard evidence, but it's out of pain that his questions come. And then the third story we'll look at is of Peter. This is chapter 21. You know, the disciples have experienced the resurrected Jesus, and this gives them great joy, but it also is just very perplexing. Like, now what? Right? It's not like Jesus is hanging around with them for days on end. He, like, comes and then goes, shows up in locked rooms, and then leaves. It's weird, you know, and they don't know what to do. Like, it's amazing, but what does it mean for their lives? And so do you know what they do? They go back to what they know. They go back to fishing. They travel north to the Sea of Galilee, probably back to Peter's home. And in verse 4, early in the morning, after they had been fishing all night, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. So Jesus calls out, "Hey, have you caught anything?" "Oh, no, nothing." "Throw your net out on the right side of the boat." Whatever. They do. They take in this haul of fish, which reminds them of the first time that they encountered Jesus, and the light bulb goes off. They realize who it is. Peter, classically, jumps into the water and swims to shore, and there they have breakfast with Christ. And then in verse 15, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time, he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." So three resurrection stories, and in each of them, we find three themes or threads running throughout them. And I just want to highlight each of those here for a moment. The first that we see in all three stories is this, that in our pain, doubt, and mistakes, we often don't recognize Jesus. The disciples don't recognize that Jesus is calling them from the shore. Thomas can't recognize the truth that Jesus is alive. His friend's testimony is not enough. And Mary, even though Jesus is right in front of her, does not realize it is Jesus. And I used to read Mary's story especially and kind of chuckle to myself, like, how could she not realize it was Jesus? I don't do that anymore. I have a lot of compassion for Mary because I think maybe I've now lived long enough and experienced enough pain and doubt and shame to know that when you are in the midst of those things, it is incredibly disorienting, right? When you're in the midst of pain and doubt and shame, it is hard to see clearly. I experienced this with some physical pain a few months ago. I was doing some work in our backyard. And to get from our home to our backyard, you have to go down two steps. And on either side of those steps, on the either side of those steps are two rectangle pieces of concrete. They're about knee height. I come out of the house in a hurry. I've gotten whatever I need. And I make a turn to head this way into the backyard. And my knee catches the corner of that concrete. And I collapse in pain. I am rolling around on the ground. I cannot breathe. I am in so much pain. I'm wondering, has my leg been severed? What is going on? I didn't see it coming. I'm down on the ground. All I can think about is the pain. All I can see is the pain. The only thing in front of me is the pain. I can't see anything else. This is true with physical pain. It's true with emotional pain. It's true when we have questions, when there's doubt, cynicism running through us. Those things tend to overwhelm us. You ever notice that? Those things are very disorienting. They make it very hard to see clearly. And I point all of this out. I mean, you're like, isn't this an Easter message? And isn't it supposed to be kind of happy and, you know, joyful and all those sorts of things? This feels, you know. I point it all out because I want you to see that nowhere in these stories does Jesus shame Mary, Thomas, Peter for their doubt or their pain or their confusion. He doesn't hold it over them, rub their nose in it. He doesn't even like say you're a bad person or how come you don't have more faith or why don't you have your act together. It's not his response to them. And I think that's quite remarkable because we tend to respond to our pain and our doubt and our shame that way. We tend to beat ourselves up, don't we? And think we're pretty miserable people. Why don't we have our act together? What's wrong with us? And we tend to shame to talk ourselves down. Jesus does not do that to us. Instead, this is what he does. He seeks us out and stays with us. Jesus meets Mary where she is. She doesn't recognize him at first, but he stays with her long enough for her to recognize him. The disciples are out in that boat, and they don't recognize that it's Jesus on shore, but he calls to them, comes and finds them on the Sea of Galilee, and then stays with them until they recognize who he is. And then there's Thomas. I love Thomas's story because the text seems to make it pretty clear that the entire reason for Jesus' visit that night is for Thomas. The other disciples, they've already seen Jesus. They've had the joy of encountering the resurrected Christ, not Thomas. You know, again, he was missing that week ago when Jesus came out getting groceries or something. You know, it has to happen. You run out of milk, somebody's got to go get it. So Thomas isn't there. So why does Jesus come that night? It's for him. Thomas's doubt does not deter Jesus from showing up. In fact, it's the very reason for his coming. And again, I think this is hard for us to believe, because if we're in a place of doubt or pain or shame where our mistakes feel overwhelming to us, we tend to think that there's no way God would ever come close. Right? Why would God come close to me? I'm a mess. If you really knew my life, if you really knew what was in me and the decisions I make, you would never imagine that God would come close, would seek me out, and would stay with me until I had eyes to see him. And yet that is what these three stories remind us is true. Yes, pain and doubt and shame can be disorienting, but God meets us in those very places. God comes to us and meets us where we are. And in that very place, out of our pain, doubt, and mistakes, Jesus grows something new. Out of Mary's despair comes joy. Out of Thomas's doubt comes faith. Peter's shame is transformed into affirmation and purpose. In all three of these stories, Jesus is growing something new out of the pain and the doubt and the mistakes. It's there in all three of those stories, and yet, I'm not sure we believe it, at least for our own lives. Right? When we're in these places of upheaval, we often can't imagine that anything new or good could ever come. Anybody ever been there? The pain is so great, the loss so significant, the shame so overwhelming, the mistake so significant, that we tell ourselves there is no way anything good could ever come of this. It's like rolling around on the ground wondering if your knee's been severed. All you can see is the pain, right? I think this is probably what Mary and Thomas and Peter all must have felt when Jesus took his last breath. When they heard of his death, or when they saw it with their own eyes, I imagine that they thought to themselves, how could anything good or new ever come out of this? Because death always has the final word, right? Pain and loss and heartache, they never give way to joy, do they? Shame can't be forgiven. Doubt can't lead to a deeper faith, right? And this is what we tell ourselves over and over again, it's what we're tempted to think, but Easter is the story, not of what we expect to be true, but of what we could have never expected. The resurrection invites us to awaken our imaginations, to have eyes to see not what is, but what could be. Because like I said at the beginning, the resurrection was not an event that just happened a couple of thousand years ago. It is still happening today in you, in me, right now. I know sometimes we look at our lives and it feels an awful lot like the only thing that our life is just kind of dirt and mud and muck. We look at our pain, at our mistakes, at our doubt and our cynicism, and all we see is a mess. It's just a dirty mess. Have you ever felt like your life is like that? And I think when we're in this place, we just can't imagine that anything good or new would ever come out of it. But then Jesus seeks us out. He comes to where we are, and he stays with us in order for something new to come out of the mud and the dirt of our lives. See, we've been talking around here for a number of weeks about the way in which Jesus plants a seed in the mess that we are. In fact, a few weeks ago, we talked about the command in the Old Testament to lament. Anybody know lament? Know what lament is? Probably not, because we don't do it a whole lot. We don't really love it as Americans. You know, we'd rather roll up our sleeves and press on, but lament is being willing to say life is not as it should be. My life is a mess, or the world's a mess, right? And so we talked about lament that Sunday morning, and we wrote laments down and pinned them up on the boards and did all that, but we also talked about how in lament, one of the things that happens is that you don't just cry out and dress up in burlap and ash, but you also remind yourself of what is true of God's past faithfulness, of the promises of God. And as you're doing that, you're essentially planting a seed in the mud and muck. And so we did that. We planted seeds a few weeks ago. And this is the result so far. Can you see this? See the little guys. I don't know what you felt like if you were here that Sunday or if you've ever held a seed in your hand, but they're not really impressive, are they? I mean, this little speck of something. What is it? It's nothing. It's so insignificant. It's not even pretty. It's not an attractive color. It's usually like a brown or, you know, there's nothing about a seed that makes you go, wow. You know, unless, of course, you think about what it becomes. And after a few weeks, here we are, you know, we have these beginnings of something that if we let these things grow, do you know what this is going to become? Do you remember what we planted? At least I think some of the seeds were this. Do you remember what it was? What kind of plant? It was a sunflower. So this thing is going to be 7 feet tall and have a gorgeous yellow flower full of seeds for the next generation. Out of what? Some piddly little unimpressive thing that got planted in the mess and in the dirt. This is Easter. God coming into our lives, into the mess, into the mud and muck, staying with us, nurturing us, restoring us, planting seeds that lead to life. And those seeds may take weeks, years, maybe even a decade before we can look back and see what God has done in us and out of our pain and our doubt and our mistakes. But there it is nonetheless, resurrection. And so today I want to invite you to remember the resurrection and your resurrection. You have been resurrected. You are being resurrected. In the midst of the pain and the doubt and the mistakes, God is planting something new. And out of that, even though you can't believe it because it's so unimpressive and dirty and messy, out of that, God is growing something new. You are a part of the resurrection. And to help us kind of cement that in our minds this morning, because it's a big idea, and there's so much within us that doubts that that could ever be true, we're going to share in this meal here at the table. And we put the table in the middle. That's weird. That wasn't an accident, though, if you're kind of like, no, didn't want, what happened? This was very intentional. We wanted to put this in the middle of the room, in the middle of us, this table that we gather around today. This reminder, yes, of the sacrifice of Christ and of the resurrection. Because this meal, I say this, you know, from time to time around here, just to remind us, is not just about the past. It's probably where our minds tend to go, but it is also about the present and the future. This meal reminds us, yes, that Christ's body was broken, and it reminds us that Christ is with us now, feeding us, sustaining us in this moment. And it's about the future, the promise that one day, all of God's people from every nation and tribe and tongue throughout time will gather around the table of the wedding banquet. And it's going to be a party. And we will celebrate the coming of the bridegroom with his bride. And so this is about the past and the present and the future. And I think when we share communion and we're mindful of the past, like we were on Good Friday, for example, there's a very somber and reflective tone to that sharing of the meal. When it's about the present, though, and the future, when those two things are in our view, well, then I think there's all sorts of reason for joy and celebration and for things to get a little rowdy, if you will, right? Because I don't think that the banquet in heaven is going to be a somber, pass the salt, sort of experience, you know? It's going to be a party. So here's what we're going to do today. We're going to invite you to come to this table, but we're going to do it in a non-orderly, slightly chaotic and rowdy way, okay? Typically, we'd form lines, and you'd get in line, Stan. Hold on, hold on. I know you're coming. I like it. We'd form lines, and we'd figure it out somehow. We're not going to do that today. There'll be four people. I do realize, Teresa, we need two more of these, if you would be so kind. Thanks so much. One person kind of on each side of the table. They will each have a bread and a cup, and you can just come. And that means you're going to have to, like, to get here to one of these sides, you're going to have to kind of work your way through the crowd and, you know, dance a little bit, maybe hug somebody on your way in, I don't know, you know, high five. And you're going to have to get to the table here, and it's going to be a little loud and a little chaotic and hopefully full of joy. Full of joy. That out of our pain and our doubt and our mistakes, Jesus grows something new. That in the mess of this life, resurrection happens for us. Amen? Amen. So, here she comes right on time. Thank you so much.